Okay, we're ready to start. I want to read Romans chapter 7, verses 1 through 13. We resumed our study in Romans a couple of weeks ago and looked at the first chapter 6 in two lessons, and now I'm going to take, Lord willing, two lessons to look at chapter 7. Romans 7:1. Or do you not know, brethren, for I speak to those who know the law, that the law has dominion over a man as long as he lives? For the woman who has a husband is bound by the law to her husband as long as she lives, as he lives. But if the husband dies, she is released from the law of her husband. So then, if while her husband lives, she marries another man, she will be called an adulteress. But if her husband dies, she is freed from that law, so that she is no adulteress, though she has married another man. Therefore, my brethren, you also have become dead to the law through the body of Christ, that you may be married to another, to him who was raised from the dead, that we should bear fruit to God. For when we were in the flesh, the sinful passions which were aroused by the law were at work in our members to bear fruit to death. But now we have been delivered from the law, having died to that to what we were held by, so that we should serve in the newness of the Spirit and not in the oldness of the letter. What shall we say then? Is the law sin? Certainly not. On the contrary, I would not have known sin except through the law. For I would not have known covetousness unless the law had said, "You shall not covet." But sin, taking opportunity by the commandment, produced in me all manner of evil desire. For apart from the law, sin was dead. I was alive once without the law, but when the commandment came, sin revived, and I died. And the commandment which was to bring life, I found to bring death. For sin, taking occasion by the commandment, deceived me, and by it killed me. Therefore the law is holy, and the commandment holy and just and good. Has then what is good become death to me? Certainly not. But sin, that it might appear sin, was producing death in me through what is good, so that sin through the commandment might become exceedingly sinful. All right, as I said, we've talked in the last couple of weeks about Romans chapter 6, where the Apostle Paul talks about the necessity, because we are joined to Christ, of a new life. He talks about death to sin for the believer as a fact, something that's accomplished and to be believed and then to be worked out, and the life that comes from union with Christ and his resurrection as also a fact, which is to be believed and to be worked out. In chapter 7, the apostle turns to from the dominant theme of thinking of sin as a lord, as we saw last week, as a taskmaster, as it was and now is broken and no longer that way. He turns from that concept to a discussion of the law and the question of how the law plays a part in this bondage that we've been talking about. Now, you can see the connection if you just compare, for example, 6:10, we died to sin, Paul says in Romans 16, and in 7:4, he says we are dead to the law. And in a similar way, he talks about freedom from slavery. 6:18, we were set free from sin. 7:6, we have been delivered from the law, the same idea of being set free. Okay, so he's going to talk about the place of the law, and in some ways, if you just look at that parallel, you'd say, well, they are the same. That is, law works the same way as sin. You might say they're collaborators in our demise, in our state of bondage. But Paul takes great pains in this chapter to say that's not actually the case, that sin uses the law. You might say the law is an unwitting accomplice in the work of sin and bringing us into bondage. One commentator used the phrase cat's paw, which is a phrase from an old fable, where the same idea is that sin uses someone else, an accomplice, but in this an unwitting accomplice, unwilling accomplice, to bring about this bondage. And so the point that Paul makes is much more subtle, and that's why in the first six verses, after having talked about how we're dead to the law, there's a shift in verse 7 and following where he talks about really the goodness of the law. Okay, and this is an important point. Sorry for the long introduction again, but there's no question that sin is bad. Okay, right? I mean, even the little kids say sin is bad. But the law is not bad. The law is not evil. And Paul takes great pains, especially in the last part of the chapter, starting in verse 7, to explain how it is that we can be in this condition, that we are dead to the law, and that that's a necessary part of our salvation. He takes great pains to explain how that can be, and yet the law can be, as he says later, holy and just and good. And I hope you have the same reaction. We sing in Psalm 119, "Oh, how I love thy law," except it's not that way in the metrical version anymore. It's certainly an important part of our piety, if you want to use that word, to cultivate the use of the law in growth and holiness. And I'll come back to that point. The Apostle Paul is therefore very careful to explain, when he talks about the necessity of death to the law, exactly what he means. Now, I thought I would read at the beginning J.I. Packer's summary. This is a book on sanctification. I may give a little bit of a bibliography on sanctification next week, but I thought I would at least read what Packer says. He's really pointing from chapter 7, verse 7 and following, but it's a good summary for our discussion today about what the law can do and what the relationship between God's law and sin is. He says, in Paul's analysis, the main points seem to be three. One, so just think of this as main points for our discussion, especially the last part of the passage we read. The effect of the law is to give men knowledge of sin, not merely of the abstract notion of sin, but of sin as a concrete dynamic reality within themselves, a spirit of rebellion against God and of disobedience to his commandments. Two, the way in which the law gives this knowledge is by declaring God's prohibitions and commands, for these first goad sin into active rebellion and then make men aware of the specific transgressions and shortcomings of motive and deed into which sin has led them. Three, the law gives no ability to anyone to perform the good which it prescribes, nor can it deliver from the power of sin. Okay, so those main points will be very helpful. Some of those we've already talked about, and again, I hope to explain as we go along how they come up in this chapter, or point out the places. Packer does that in the outline that he gives there. But those points are important, and they emphasize again up front the need for Paul to explain why we need to be dead to the law. That is an important part of his explanation of our deliverance through Christ. Okay, so that's the introduction, and the first verse of this starts with a question. Do you not know, brethren, that the law has dominion over a man as long as he lives? Now here he's speaking of a general fact that everyone recognized. I mean, this is not what he's saying, but it would be like, you know, dead men tell no tales. It's that sort of statement. Everyone would realize that when someone dies, you know, the sheriff isn't going to come after him anymore. That's the general idea. The law binds a person as long as he lives. And the way he's going to work that out then, he presents in verses 2 and 3 by means of an analogy. Okay, now you have to follow what Paul is saying carefully so you can be confused a little bit, and then so I can explain what it is he's saying and why he says it the way he does. So he has this general statement, the law has dominion over a man as long as he lives, and then he explains in terms of an analogy where he's going. It's in terms of a woman and her husband. And he says a woman is bound by the law to her husband as long as he lives. So if she has a husband and she marries another man while she has a husband, then she's considered an adulteress. Okay, that's something plain. The Jews would have understood that from the law, but it's I think it's something that most cultures at least would recognize. But Paul says if the husband dies, then she's released from the law of her husband. She's free to marry another person if her husband dies. Okay, and that's a fairly clear statement of fact, something that the Jews again would have recognized from their law. And that's Paul's analogy. Now, if you want to press further and say it's not an analogy, but it's an allegory, the question would be, who does the woman represent? And the answer is, well, us, as those who are believers. Okay, and that's what he says in verse 4, therefore, my brethren, you also. Okay, so he's talking, and to some sense, he's making the parallel between us and the woman. And then on the other hand, the law would be the one to whom we were married. Okay, and then you see what's the problem in the analogy is he doesn't say that the law died. He says, you have become dead to the law in verse 4. Does everyone see what so if you follow along, it's not actually an allegory, because if he were pressing the point, he would say the law became dead. But it's important for him to explain the analogy in these terms, because he wants us to become dead to the law and to be married to another so that we could bear fruit, as he says in verse 4. So although, again, it's not a strict allegory and you shouldn't interpret it that way, the point is fairly clear, and that is it's necessary for us to die so that that marriage bond to the law should be severed. Someone has to die, and the way he explains it here is that we die to the law. And the reason we die to the law is not just to be dead, but it is, in verse 4, a point that he has already emphasized in chapter 6, and that is that we would be married to another, to Christ, who has been raised from the dead. Now, that part, that's the purpose, okay? The whole point of our dying to the law is not so that we will become lawless, okay? And that is, in fact, a point that Paul has already taken great pains to explain. Right? That was the opening question in chapter 6, shall we continue in sin that grace may abound? And he emphasizes again and again that, in fact, we are to bear fruit, the bearing fruit of righteousness. So when he says we die to the law, he doesn't mean, okay, now just go out and do whatever you like. He says instead, we have become dead to the law so that we could be married to another. Okay, and that then completes the analogy. Then we are now married to Christ, and he has been raised from the dead, and as Paul expressed in chapter 6, it's because Christ is raised to the dead and we're joined to Christ that we have life, and we are therefore to bear fruit. It's better than beeping. Okay, so it's not that bad. Now, I want you to notice this point and to see exactly how it connects with what Paul has been talking about. I want to emphasize again the statement he made in chapter 6, verse 14. So, thank you. So, just look back at chapter 6, verse 14. For sin shall not have dominion over you, for you are not under law, but under grace. And I emphasized last week that when Paul says you are not under law, but under grace, positively, he is saying that we have all of the resources we need, if you want to put it that way, for righteous living, because we are under grace, because we are joined to Christ, because we have his life, and as we'll see, especially in chapter 8, because his spirit is at work in us. But you see, what Paul is saying is that if you want to be under grace, if you want to be joined to Christ, first it must happen that you're dead to the law. And that's, if you like, the point of the negative side of verse 14. You are not under law. I emphasized last week that, again, Paul doesn't mean that we are lawless when he says we're not under law. We already noted, for example, in verse 17 that Paul refers to the teaching, and especially the, you might say, the ethical teaching, the commandments they are to follow, in terms of a form of doctrine. So there was a law which they were taught and which they were expected to follow. But as I emphasized last week, the not under law is what Packer was talking about in his summary of the rest of chapter 7. That is, law and being under law, as Paul means it here, means you look to the law for all of your resources. And the law is not intended in that way to work sanctification. The law tells you what you're supposed to do, and it promises blessing for doing it, but it doesn't lift, if you will, one finger to help you do it. Okay, that being under the law means you look to the law for your justification, but you're unable to be justified that way. And you look to the law for blessing and life, but the law only gives blessing and life to those who perfectly obey, and that's not you, as it is, as it were. So that's again the point that he makes in chapter 7, verse 4, and I want to emphasize that positively. That's the reason why Paul says we have to be dead to the law. We have a, if you like, an unfruitful husband, one who can't help us to bear fruit, but the law in that sense is not established to do that. But if we are joined to Christ, then we will bear fruit to God, as he says in Romans 7:4. Now, Paul explains that further in verses 5 and 6. So 7, I should have said this at the beginning, but 7, 1 through 6 is really one paragraph, one main part of his argument. And then he's going to explain, starting in verse 7, and I did make this point before, how he can say such things about the holy law of God. But so then he concludes this opening paragraph in verses 5 and 6 by explaining how it is that being joined to the law is not a fruitful thing. Actually, he does say it's a fruitful thing. It's just the wrong kind of fruit. So look at verse 5. For when we were in the flesh, the sinful passions which were aroused by the law were at work in our members to bear fruit to death. Oh, I thought we had plenty of room. You can get rid of that coat if you want. At least my coat that's there. So he says that when we were in the flesh, and there he's talking about us and our natural condition, the law does something which we might say a priori, that is, without having experienced it, we might be surprised to see. That is, the law, instead of helping us to bear fruit to God, arouses sinful passions. Mm-hmm. So that's the difficulty, as it were. The difficulty is that this union to the law, instead of what we would like, it says in verse 5, bears fruit to death. But the contrast in verse 6 is we have been delivered from the law. And as I already said, that's the idea of freedom that he talked about in chapter 6, freedom from sin as this taskmaster, which we have realized because of Christ. Now we have been delivered from the law in the same way, having died to what we were held by, so that we should serve in the newness of the Spirit and not in the oldness of the letter. Now, the points that he's making there, he's about to explain a little bit further. And the sense in which the flesh has sinful passions aroused by the law, he's going to develop further in the verses that follow. So I'm not going to talk about that right now, but I want you to see the necessity, again, for our relationship to the law, as I've explained it, to be severed, and for us instead to be joined to Christ. And the result, he says, will be that we will serve in the newness of the Spirit and not in the oldness of the letter. So the Spirit there in the New King James Version, the S is capitalized. I think that's correct. It's the Holy Spirit. It's not like we serve with a new and renewed vigor or something like that. It's the Holy Spirit and not in the oldness of the letter. And there's I didn't need the marker board today, but one cross-reference that would be helpful here is 2 Corinthians 3:6, where Paul talks at greater length about this sort of contrast. Let me first say, again, briefly what Paul is not saying. When he says, serve in the newness of the Spirit and not in the oldness of the letter, he's not saying that the Mosaic Law or the Ten Commandments were merely superficial, and they only talked about, you know, how you're supposed to dress or, you know, not drinking coffee or chewing gum or something like that. When he contrasts the newness of the Spirit and the oldness of the letter, he's not saying, you know, in the past you were a fundamentalist and, you know, you couldn't dance or whatever, go with girls who do whatever that rhyme is. You know, you couldn't do that kind of stuff. That's not what he's saying. And if you want any proof of that, the one commandment he cites in the immediate context is the commandment not to covet. Now, does that sound like a superficial commandment? Does that sound like something that's in the deadness of the letter? Well, certainly not at all. So that's not the point. But the letter emphasizes again what the law is. The law is a commandment from God. It tells you what to do, and it promises blessing for doing it. But the letters don't jump off the page and help you do it, right? The inscription on the tablets that Moses carried didn't actually prevent the Israelites from worshiping the golden calf while Moses was receiving them. It was, in that sense, the letter is inert. It's unable to help us. But the Holy Spirit, who renews us and gives us a newness of life, is the one who enables us to serve God. So again, the emphasis is not on lack of service or fruitlessness, as if once we are dead to the law, that means we can do whatever we like. Paul has already made it plain that if we are indeed dead to the law and united to Christ, what we want to do is serve God. But the emphasis is that this is accomplished in the newness of the Spirit. And as I've already mentioned, that the emphasis on the Holy Spirit and His work will especially be developed in chapter 8. Paul mentions that here, but doesn't really develop it. Okay, so Paul here then in these opening six verses of chapter 7 has emphasized that we are dead to the law because that was a fruitless relationship, at least as far as good fruit goes. It was fruitful to death, but not the kind of marriage relationship that one would relish. And Paul says we are dead to the law because the law produced in us these sinful passions worked by sin. But he says that that relationship is severed, and we are no longer, in that sense, looking to the law as our resource, as the way by which we can be accepted with God. Now, as I said, the immediate question to any pious Jew's mind would be, what? Are you criticizing the law? Are you saying the law is evil? And that's what he turns to next, and I'll try to summarize that argument then, but let me pause here and see if you guys know what I'm saying. Any comments or questions on this part? Okay, so chapter 7, verse 7 begins then with another question. Paul likes to do this. What shall we say then? Is the law sin? And the answer is, of course, no, certainly not. It's a strong negative response. Now, what Paul does then is say that, in fact, the law is good. And what he has been saying all along is that the law is used by sin. So I said it's the cat's paw of sin, as it were, the unwitting agent of sin in the work that brings condemnation and unfruitfulness. And he explains in the verses that follow how it is that that comes about. And he wants to explain how it is that law is used by sin. But his special point is to emphasize that it's a good thing. Okay, and it's easy to get confused in the middle of it. If the verses this week won't confuse you, then wait till the last part of the chapter, which Lord willing we'll look at next week. This controversial passage about Paul saying, I'm under sin, does that mean he's a Christian or is he not a Christian? And all of that, it's easy to forget the main point, and the main point is that the law is good. It's quite remarkable, isn't it, that Paul, in the middle of the discussion of our being set free from sin to serve God, takes a long time to discuss the goodness of the law of God and to help us understand the sense in which he means we are set free from it. And to emphasize, in fact, the positive function that the law has. So that's where he's going. And I think it's important for us to see how he goes about it. And how he goes about it is talking about it in the first person. I would not have known sin except through the law. I would have not have known covetous unless the law had said, and I was alive in verse 9 once without the law. Okay, so the first question that has to be asked and answered is, who is the I here? Okay. Now maybe you never thought of that. Like, duh, of course, Paul's writing the letter, so it's Paul. And that's actually where I'm going to come eventually. That is not the only way these verses have been interpreted. Let me explain before I explain the other ways that I think it's fairly clear that when Paul talks this way, what I have known, he's not talking as if, well, this is what happened to me, but you may have had your own experience, something like that, you know. It's true for me, it may be true for you, or something like that. Now, he's speaking of this as, you might say, the universal experience. Now, Paul was a Jew, and so he had a special encounter with the law as given in the Ten Commandments. I mean, that is the moral law, which in a sense, as Paul has already said in Romans 2, is known to everyone. But here Paul is probably emphasizing his own experience as a Jew, and yet he speaks in ways that are applicable to everyone. So I want you to keep that in mind as he reads it. Whether Jew or Gentile, the confrontation with the law as it comes to our consciousness and the explicitness of the requirement and the demand for perfect obedience, Paul is saying, this is the universal effect of that in everyone. So although he says I, and it's autobiographical in that sense, it is an explanation of the experience of everyone. Now, I'll just mention two other possibilities. There are actually a lot of other explanations that are given. One explanation that's given is that Paul is actually speaking of the experience of Adam. This is actually kind of interesting if you think through it, because when Paul talks about, I was alive without the law, but when the commandment came, sin revived and I died, Adam is really the only one who, in the absolute sense, was alive and then died in response to the commandment. And there are other aspects like the deception aspect, that was really Eve rather than Adam, make this kind of an interesting point of view for understanding what Paul is saying. Another view, which is probably more popular now than it was earlier, is a view in which Paul is speaking of the experience of Israel, and specifically Israel as they came to Mount Sinai and they received the law. And that there are parallels between Adam and Israel that are, I think, biblical, but this view especially emphasizes the fact that Israel is to be spoken of here, and that Paul has an emphasis on the Mosaic law as, you might say, a law code, which is therefore broken for the believer. Now, I don't think that's an accurate explanation, and that explanation, by the way, does have implications for the way you think about the Old Testament law as it relates to the believer, which I think are unscriptural implications. But I think it's at least the immediate reading suggests that Paul is talking about himself as a representative of every man, if you want to put it that way. And I don't really see anything in the text that would lead us to think otherwise. So that's the way I'm going to explain it. And if you want more references, I can give you others. Okay. So Paul then, as I said, is explaining how it is that the law had this effect, because in the end he wants to justify why the law is good. And he says at the beginning, I would not have known sin except through the law. Now Paul has already said something very similar to this in Romans 3:20. At the end of the case he makes against, he says, all flesh really, every person, he says, therefore by the deeds of the law no flesh will be justified in his sight, for by the law is the knowledge of sin. You see, that's a very similar thing. He's saying, you know, if you're asking what the law can do for you, in Romans 3:20, he's saying, well, it can't justify you, because he's just listed the way in which all people break the law. But what the law can do for you is give you the knowledge of sin. Okay, now, that's not a bad thing. Part of Paul's argument here, but if you flip to Romans 3, we're back in Romans 7, and he says, I would not have known sin except through the law. It's the same sort of thing, except it's not, you might say, a mere mental knowledge of the law. And this is the point that Packer makes. I think it's the first in his outline of this last part of chapter 7. It's not merely knowing the commandments, like, oh, I didn't realize I wasn't supposed to covet. Now I know I'm not supposed to covet. It's not that. It's the registering in our consciousness that I have an enemy within, that the law is condemning something that I actually do, that I am a law breaker. So knowing sin is not merely an intellectual knowledge, although that's fundamental to it. It is the fact, and this becomes clear as it works out, it is the fact that I am a lawbreaker. I am convicted by the law of my sin. For I would not have known covetousness unless the law had said, you shall not covet. So as I mentioned, Paul then brings out one example, a specific commandment for us to think about. Okay? And you know what? You know, he might have brought up the example of, let's see, if you touch a corpse, then you have to wash yourself so many times. You know, he might have picked some reference from Leviticus, which we would have considered quite obscure. And then we would have been much more comfortable. Okay? But instead he goes to the 10th commandment, which touches, as I already said, on the heart, on our inward desires, lest anyone say, oh, well, you know, the law doesn't really have to deal with the things that I struggle with. You know, it's all in externals. No, he says, I would not have known covetousness, this consuming desire, unless the law had said, you shall not covet. Now, apparently there's some evidence that the Jews understood the 10th commandment in a way as summarizing all of them. And if you think about it, they're all connected, but it is a way to think about, you know, Paul says covetousness is idolatry. Okay, so there goes the first commandment if you're a coveter. And you can see how wise and insightful Paul's use of this is, or if you like, how wise and insightful God's giving us the 10th commandment is, because Paul points to that and says, that's the one that really got me. And he says that in the verses that follow. It says, sin taking opportunity by the commandment in verse 8 produced in me all manner of evil desire. And that statement of producing in me all manner of evil desires is similar to what he said in verse 5, the sinful passions which were aroused by the law. And he says that same sort of thing again in the context. And it's worth maybe stepping back a minute and thinking about how is it that sin produces in people evil desire? How is it that sinful passions are aroused how is it that law is used by sin to do that? How does that happen? Well, the short answer is that Paul doesn't really spell it out here. Okay, so you have to think about other scriptures say, and maybe a reflection on universal human experience. But the first and most important thing, and I think this is crucial for thinking about where Paul has been in Romans before he's been here, is that one way evil desire is produced in us by the law, is used by sin, is that we seek to be right with God by keeping the law, which is a great affront to God. We hear the law and we think, no problem, I can do that. And I can make myself acceptable to God by obedience to the law. That's a sinful passion. That's a rebellion against God. And of course, that's the case. And as I said, Paul has already talked in the first part of Romans about our justification by faith alone, through the righteousness of another. And so I would say that's in the background of what Paul is saying. In terms of what you might say universal experience, it is what is sometimes called, I guess, the forbidden fruit syndrome. Right, so Sam and I were talking this morning. We think it's a piece of art. We're not sure. Over in the room where we worship, by where the children's table is. Okay, it's within reach. Okay, now, what should we do? Well, we could tell them not to go near it. We could put chairs around it. We could write a sign, although that age group probably wouldn't read the sign. Now, what do you think the response would be? Wow, this must be good. They put chairs around it, right? So let's go after it. And you can see this in Augustine's Confessions. He talks about the fruit, right? The fruit was sweeter because he stole it. Okay, that is something that I think the scriptures, that explanation is justified by other scriptures, not the action, but the justification of that explanation I think you could find elsewhere. But that is probably a large part of what Paul has in mind here. And when he talks about sin being dead and my being alive without the law, it is not the case that he was sinless. Okay, he was alive apart from the law. The law came to him and suddenly, boom, I'm a sinner. No, the idea is sin is inert, and it's like sin is this sleeping beast which has control of the household. Okay, but the law comes along and, as it were, kicks you into action, and then you got real trouble. Okay, that's the picture here. It is not that he was coasting along fine and sinless. It was that the terrible condition he was in was beyond his reckoning. He hadn't even thought about what his condition was like until the commandment came to him, until thou shalt not covet pushed on the sore spot, the ulcer, as Calvin uses that in another connection. And he said, ow, that's the sinful passion that's aroused by the law. It's a recognition both of his own sinful condition and the immediate response, which is not submission to God, but rebellion against God. So this is the point that Packer makes. The response that comes to us through the law is further rebellion against God. It is, you might say, open rebellion, whereas before we had simply been serving quietly with the enemy, and now we take up arms and rebel against God. Now that's the picture that he gives for what happens when the law comes to us. And he points out in verse 10 then what a perversion that is of the intent of the law. So in verse 10 he says, the commandment which was to bring life, I found to bring death. I thought I would read from Murray's comment here. The point is that the commandment was intended to bring life. The commandment actually promises life. Think of the fifth commandment, for example, and other promises in the law that obedience will bear good fruit. And Murray says this, the purpose of law in man's original estate was not to give occasion to sin, but to direct and regulate man's life in the path of righteousness, and therefore to guard and promote life. By reason of sin, however, that same law promotes death in that it gives occasion to sin, and the wages of sin is death. The more law is registered in our consciousness, the more sin is aroused to action, and law merely as law can exercise no restraining or remedial effect. That the law was found to be unto death reflects on the tragedy of Paul's own experience and the disappointment, the disillusionment which overtook him. You see here, Paul is looking at the law. He's a, if you want to think of him as a special case, he's a faithful Jew. And he looks at the law and he says, life. But what was the result? Death. And the question is, how can that happen? And he explains in verse 11 one more time that it happened because sin takes occasion by the commandment. It deceives me and kills me. Let me just explain briefly that the word in the New King James, taking occasion in verse 11, is the same in the original as in verse 8, taking opportunity. It was actually used in a military sense. I talked about the military sort of subcontext in chapter 6 in terms of the weapons and the slave as this tyrant. Payday was a bad time last week. But here, the idea of taking opportunity is the idea of the establishment of a position in enemy territory to make a further attack. And that bridgehead or base of operations, that's the way the word is used in other occasions. It's not clear whether Paul has that in the forefront, but that's certainly the idea here, is that, you know, the law is on, you might say, God's side. It's not on sin's side, but sin establishes a base of operations through the law, and by it attacks us. And Paul says in verse 11 that it deceived me, and by it killed me. And again, I'm reading several quotes today, but this is what Hodge has to say about this, this idea of deception. He expected life and found death. He expected happiness and found misery. He looked for holiness and found increased corruption. He fancied that by the law, all these desirable ends could be secured when its operation was discovered to produce the directly opposite effect. Sin, therefore, deceived by the commandment, and by it slew him, instead of its being to him the source of holiness and blessedness. So, Paul then explains how it is that sin did these things. And he concludes in verse 12 what may seem to us not the logical conclusion, unless we're thinking about where Paul is going. He says in verse 12, Therefore, the law is holy, and the commandment holy and just and good. How could he say, therefore, the law is holy, having said all these things? Well, he's able to say that because it wasn't the law that brought these things about. And the law would not bring these things about in the case it was originally intended to serve, that is, the case of a righteous one. But the law is therefore holy because the law is completely innocent in this transaction. It's not the fault of the law. If you will, the law is doing exactly what it's supposed to do. It's telling us what God requires. It's promising life. It has the incentive to obey built in. And that's why Paul can say the law is holy, the commandment is holy, just, and good. When he's saying holy, just, and good, he's saying the law reflects the holiness, justice, and goodness of the God who gave it. The law is holy and just and good because God is holy and just and good. And Paul will therefore not question any of that. That point may become a little bit clearer if we look at verse 13, and this is as far as I'm going to try to get today. That verse 13 is sort of a transition between the section we just looked at, verses 7 through 12, and the verses that follow, 14 through 25. But I want to connect it with the preceding verses this week, and then, Lord willing, next week we'll connect it with the verses that follow. Because Paul asks another question. Has then what is good become death to me? Okay, it's as if, I'm sorry, Paul, I didn't get that therefore. How is there a therefore, you know? Has then what is good become death to me? If it really is holy and just and good, has then what is good become death to me? And Paul, of course, says no, certainly not. And here he states positively what he has really been stating in a negative way through the whole discussion. Sin that it might appear sin was producing death in me through what is good, so that sin through the commandment might become exceedingly sinful. What he's saying is that sin used the law to kill me, but the law actually brings something good out of all of that. And what the law brings out of all of that is showing the exceeding sinfulness of sin. There's a Puritan paperback, I think, by that name, The Sinfulness of Sin. And that's what Paul is emphasizing here. The law in twisting something good, sin in twisting something good, namely the law, to an evil purpose, sin in deceiving us, sin in producing death to what is good, is shown in its true colors. And it's only because of the law that that could happen. Right? Without the law, we wouldn't realize the tremendous sinfulness of sin. We wouldn't know and see that sin has become exceedingly sinful. So the positive purpose, as Paul summarizes it here, is the fact that we come to recognize through the law our terrible condition. We might have been just lulled to sleep, thinking everything was fine. But the fact that sin used the law to produce this in us was the necessary prerequisite for us to realize our desperate condition, and for us then to be turned to God, and for us to look out of ourselves, out of our own self-confidence and our good works, instead to look to another so that we would die to sin and to the law and live to God. Okay. Things are just falling right and left. Let me make a... Yeah. Okay, I think I'll just stop there. Any comments or questions on that?
I'm just wondering, I realize it would be a very Pelagian error or view, but has there been people who have looked at this passage and said, I was alive and I died as proof that we were born innocent and then we... Or tabula rasa?
I don't know. The commentaries that I read didn't go far enough out to give that as an explanation, but I wouldn't put it past Pelagius to say something like that. Of course, Paul has already contradicted that view earlier on in the book, but that would seem to be a possibility. It is, you do have to weaken the language of alive and dead to in some sort of a relative sense, like inert, just to make sense of what Paul is saying. So that's one attractiveness of understanding it, of referring to Adam. But I don't know of anyone who's tried that with every man.
It certainly seems like in the practical sense, for those who don't actually consult the scriptures at all, that same argument is made. You know, we wouldn't. It usually is an excuse for lawlessness.
Right.
So it's only all these restrictive Christians who use the Bible that make things to be sin that really aren't. You know, we have liberty, and it's only when we're born free that way, it's only when we start restricting ourselves with all these rules and
right.
laws of the scriptures that we even have the conscience there in the first place that he starts to be pricked. It would be fine if we didn't have all these restrictions. I'm not saying they would appeal to this passage that way. I'm just saying in a practical sense they want it to be that way.
Yeah. And in the last chapter, Paul acknowledged that in a sense people who were in sin were free. They bore their own fruit. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
If we didn't have the law, then we wouldn't have any guilt, and how much better that would be. It does say that it is holy and good.
Right. Yeah, that's right. Dave?
There's a maybe the other end of the spectrum as well that can be discovered when you read this. Paul uses one commandment to show how devastating it is, but then when you apply all 600 of them, you think, wow, that must be a cauldron of sin and death inside that's looking for a vent, looking for some way to get out. And it just so happened that he picked this one, but it's not as if there's lack of opportunity to look at other things. It's a real picture of depravity that if it's this bleak with the result of thou shalt not covet, just imagine where we'd end up if the whole law was pushed down upon us and we had opportunity.
Mm, that's a good point. Yeah. That's right. Yeah, it shows the despairing condition we're in, the desperate nature of our condition.
Sobering to contrast that with what happens most of the time when for door-to-door evangelism, a knock on the door and everybody's a pretty good person.
Uh-huh.
That's why they're comfortable.
Yeah.
Reading things like this, and nothing can be further from the truth.
Yep. Good. Let's close in prayer.